go to Peter Gross, who's standing by, and you're all very familiar with the story, of course, of Schindler, Oscar Schindler, and the movie Schindler's List, and indeed the book Schindler's Ark. But the chances are you've probably never heard of the tiny French village that saved the lives of up to 5,000 Jews during the Second World War. And Peter Gross is an author, and his book, The Greatest Escape, tells this extraordinary, untold story for the large part that has remained secret for decades. Peter, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good morning to you, Ryan.
If you wouldn't mind, I suppose, telling us about the village and how you first came by the story.
Well, I mean, of all things, I first came on the story in Sydney, Australia. A friend out there is an academic, and he lectures in genocide prevention. And he knew that I'd just moved to France. I moved to France in 2008. This was 2009. And he said, look, I've got this most fantastic story in France. It ought to be your next book. And I said, well, thanks very much, because I had a commission to do another one. And so I sort of had a cursory look at it and thought, my God, this story is extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the more I looked into it, the more compelling it became. So that's how I came upon it, from Australia.
Okay, so we're talking about, is it Chambon-sur-Lignon? Is that the name of the village?
Yeah, Le Chambon-sur-Lignon is exactly right.
Okay. In terms of geography, we being an agricultural country, we'd understand farms and farmland. So maybe put us into perspective here. What class of a village are we talking about?
You'd love it there, Ryan.
Yeah.
It's very much an agricultural territory.
Okay.
It's not the easiest way to think of it is it's not that far from Geneva.
Okay.
It's over on the eastern side of France and in the mountains, just sort of in the foothills there, of an area called the Auvergne, and it's completely isolated. It's one of those things when you drive there. The first time I drove there, it was like those car journeys you do when you're a kid, where you keep saying to your father, are we there yet?
Yeah.
And you drive and you drive and you drive and you drive, and finally you come to this isolated plateau. And of course, the big thing that was its protection was that it was of zero strategic importance. It's been of zero strategic importance for the last 3,000 years. The Saracens came to France in 800 and something, and they just passed it by. It wasn't worth it. There's no coal there. There's no steel there. There's no industry there. There's nothing worth taking. So by and large, and there's no strategic route runs through it or anything like that, it's not important, and therefore it was left alone.
So pre-World War II, it lived in glorious obscurity.
I think that's a fair description of how it was there, absolutely.
Right.
People minded their own business and wanted to be left alone.
There was some history of persecuted religion, in the sense that the town was made up, as you write in the book, of mostly of Huguenot French Protestants.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And they had a tradition of shelter. I mean, they had 250 years of being belted around the ears as part of the general wars of religion.
Mm.
But after the French Revolution, when Catholic priests in particular were regarded as part of the old order and much sought after by the new order, then they were given shelter by the Protestants on the plateau. They were completely impartial in who they gave shelter to. They sheltered refugees from the Spanish Civil War, they sheltered Jews during the Second World War, and they sheltered Catholic priests after the French Revolution.
Okay, so let's get to World War II, and just as a snapshot, obviously France became occupied by the Nazis, and the French, for the most part, or for a large part, turned, and Marshal Pétain became the boss man of the German state of France, if you want to call it that, in what was called, there was the Vichy element of things. Maybe you give us the snapshot of what happened to France at that time.
Well, basically, France was invaded by Germany in 1940, and the Germans occupied three-fifths of it. They occupied the northern industrial part of France,
mm-hmm.
and they occupied the Atlantic coast so that they had control of the Atlantic ports, which they used as submarine bases during the war. But they left two-fifths of it to be run by what was, for all practical purposes, a puppet government from the town of Vichy, which is not all that far from Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, in fact.
Okay.
And as you say, it was run by a guy called Marshal Pétain, but it was a puppet government, and in its way it was more vicious, particularly towards Jews, than the Germans themselves.
So the French that were running the Vichy and were told, round up your Jews and get them out of there. And this is where we need to introduce an extraordinary character by the name of André Trocmé, if I'm saying that correctly. And why don't you bring him onto the stage now?
Absolutely. Well, André Trocmé was the pastor in the village of Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, and he was a convinced, determined, unflinching and unchanging pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
He believed as strongly as he believed in anything, he believed in pacifism. And when the war broke out on the 3rd of September 1939, or when it was declared on the 3rd of September, he preached a sermon in the church saying, look, we're going to all be asked to do terrible things. They're against the will of God. And if you're a believing and an active Christian, then you'll have nothing to do with it. Resist, resist, resist. Now, this was frankly treasonous. And yet that was Trocmé for you. He never flinched from that position throughout World War II.
There's a lovely quote from the book from Trocmé which says, we've got to resist, we do not have to do what they say, do not have to behave immorally, we must fight them with weapons of the spirit. It's a beautiful, a lyrical line.
It's an electrifying phrase, yes. Isn't it? And yeah. and Trocmé meant it. He certainly would say, resist, 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 resist. You don't have to do what these people tell you. We know what our duty is. We know that there are people in trouble. We're going to help them. It may be against the law to help them. We're still going to help them. Yeah. And so he preached this, if you like, a fundamental Christian message, but he never flickered throughout the war. There was no moment when he ever felt that the time had come to take up arms.
Okay, so enter then onto the stage the gendarmes, the police, the French police, with the order notice that was nailed to the door of whatever it was, the Centreville, and said, if the village doesn't tell us where Jews are, then you are in trouble. So when you have the French authorities / Nazi puppets doing this in a village, you know that that is the most menacing sign you can read.
Absolutely right. And the village knew exactly what to do about this. Nothing at all. For 3 weeks, the gendarmes raided farmhouses and they raided schools and hostels and all sorts of things like that. The Jews who were hiding there were moved out into the forests. And in fact, there were old sort of dugouts and stuff like that, which were left over from 250 years
really?
Ago from the Huguenot persecution. And they just simply revived them. The fact that they were still there, they kind of kept them ready and they knew what to do when they were needed. And so they would hide these people, and not a single Jew was betrayed by a single person in the village throughout World War II.
That is absolutely extraordinary. And it reminded me, actually, as I was reading it, and I hope it's not too glib a thing to say, but it did, of the movie Inglourious Basterds, the Tarantino film, where the Jews were being kept under this poor farmer's floor. Have you seen that film?
Yes, I have indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
And a very tense scene, but it just had that sense of it, that they were trying to protect the local Jewish community if they could. But the threat and the menace that hung in the air at all times.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there were notices put up saying, you know, you can be sent off to a concentration camp or indeed, you know, a prison or whatever for sheltering Jews. Sheltering Jews was illegal, particularly foreign Jews. I mean, at the beginning of World War II, there were 350,000 Jews in France, and about 200,000 of them were foreigners. And a very large number of them were Germans and Austrians who'd escaped the Nazis. And they were the ones who were absolutely in the crosshairs. They were the ones that the Germans insisted be grabbed as soon as possible.
So, well, it's good you mentioned that, because let's move the story on to the point that this village became as what's considered what might be called in modern terms a safe haven, albeit an involuntary one, if you like. How did that happen?
Well, there was several processes, and first of all, I would have thought that the first Jewish refugee came in 1938, before the war had started.
Okay.
It was a woman called Hilda Hofert, and she was a Latin teacher in Vienna. And when the Anschluss took place, when Hitler annexed Austria, she smelled a rat, and she got out. Okay. And she moved to Le Chambon-sur-Lignon, and she got a job in the new school there teaching German, and she also worked as an au pair in a hostel. And so far as I can discover, she was the first Jewish refugee in the village. And no doubt Hilda told some friends, look, there's nice people here and they'll look after you. And so the word slowly spread. But it didn't, the trickle didn't become a flow until really in 1942, when Trocmé, that we were talking about a few minutes ago, went down to Marseille and spoke to the Quakers and various others. And what he wanted to do was to go into the internment camps and sort of hand out food parcels. And the Quakers in particular said, well, don't do that. We've got plenty of people doing that. What we need is a refuge somewhere where we can send in particular children. We can very often, what we try to do is we send a doctor in and the doctor certifies the parents as medically unfit to be transported and then they're released. That usually doesn't work. If we can't save the parents, then we can save the children. We can organise for them to be transferred to a hostel outside the camp. And that's what they did. So Trokmé was instrumental in having those hostels stationed in Le Chambon and in the surrounding area so that, you had this flow, particularly of children, into the village.
Another character in the piece is Oscar Rozovsky, and he a man who still lives to this day, as you write.
Absolutely,
living near
Paris. An email from him this morning.
Really? Well, I mean, I love it. It's so important that these men's and women's stories are told, especially as they're living today, because they need to be celebrated. But let's talk about him then, Oscar Rozovsky.
Oscar Rozovsky. Well, Oscar has the most extraordinary story, I think, of the lot. He was a young Latvian Jew, and therefore a foreign Jew, and absolutely a target. And he lived in Nice, and he wanted to be a doctor. But he couldn't, under the Vichy government laws, get to university. So instead he took a job as a typewriter repairman. And his particular beat was the local prefecture. Now, in France, the prefecture is the source of all the papers. That's where you get your driving license. It's where you can get your carte d'identité and all sorts of stuff like that. So Oscar knew the machines that created these documents literally inside out. Now, his father was arrested and then his mother was arrested. So his first foray into the world of forgery was to forge papers to get his mother out of Reeve Salt internment camp, which he succeeded in doing.
Right, okay.
And so then the pair of them set off. Dad's been arrested and disappeared. They don't know where he is.
Yeah.
And they've heard from a friend that this village called Chambon-sur-Lignon will protect Jews. So they go there. And Oscar then went to, I've had a bit of a track record on this forgery business. So he went to the local resistance and said, would you like me to set up a forgery bureau? And they said, oh yeah, that's a good idea. And so Oscar, 18 years old, started forging papers. And in the course of 2 years, he forged 5,000 sets of false papers, about 3,500 for Jews and about 1,500 for people dodging the forced labor laws or for resistance guards on the run. And Oscar wasn't the man for half measures. I mean, he didn't just knock you up a carte d'identité or some ration coupons or whatever. He would produce all these supporting papers. So he would give you fake parking fines, fake library cards, fake trade union memberships, all sorts of stuff like that.
Mm.
So that if the police stopped you and said, your papers, monsieur, then out of your wallet came this blizzard of paper, all with your name on it. It was never known to fail. So far as we know, no one was ever busted for having false papers supplied by Oscar.
You talk about the village probably saving maybe 5,000 Jewish lives throughout this awful period in history. How did you alight on that figure?
I put a bit of a cautionary note on that.
Okay.
My guess is that there were 3,500 Jews rescued, but there were 1,500 others. That's the people dodging the service travail obligatoire, which is the forced labour law, and there were resistance people on the run. So 3,500 Jews is a good working number, and that's really based on Oscar Rozovsky. I mean, he said he cranked out 5,000 sets of papers,
right,
and about 3,500 were for Jews, and the 1,500 were for the others. The pastor, André Trokmé, estimated the number at 2,500. Others have put it as high as 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000. In the end, I sort of examined all these things, and I came to the conclusion that 3,500 wasn't a bad shot.
Yeah.
And if you take into account the fact that Oscar Rozovsky is credited with saving 1,200 Jews, then the people of the plateau did three times as well as Oscar Schindler.
Yeah, well, I mean, and again, it begs the question, why now? Why are we only hearing this now? Is it because you tell me why now? Sorry,
okay.
I was coming up with a load of suggestions.
No,
was it because
it's all right.
Steven Spielberg hasn't made the movie yet?
You keep talking, Brian. You know the story well.
it's your story. I'm enjoying it no end. But anyway, let's get down to business.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I've lost the question.
No, my question was, why now?
Why now?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I mean, both sides, at the end of the war, the Protestants didn't think they'd done anything special. And even to this day, if you ask them, you know, why did you do it? They say, well, we did what anyone else would have done.
So humility, essentially.
Oh, absolutely. But it's not true. What anyone else did was to look the other way and hope that things would
exactly.
go away and calm down.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They took people in. And they just said, well, you know, as I say, we did what anyone else would have done.
Mm.
So after the war, I mean, there was this terrific tradition of secrecy. And my friend Nellie Trockmay, the daughter of André Trockmay,
yeah.
the pastor, her best friend in the village was a girl called Catherine Combesedis. And Catherine ran money in suitcases for the resistance, millions of francs for the resistance, aged 15. And Nellie, as I say, Nellie was Catherine's best friend
yes.
in the village. And Nellie did not know until after the war that Catherine was doing that. That was the level of secrecy in the village.
That's quality,
so
yeah.
And these are teenagers.
Yeah.
These are kids.
Amazing generation, yeah.
Absolutely. And so there was a huge tradition of secrecy, and people, I suppose, just it had a bit of momentum. People didn't talk about it afterwards. From the point of view of the Jews who were rescued there, all they wanted to do at the end of World War II was just to forget about it. There's a dreadful episode in their lives, and they just want to put it behind them. So both sides had no interest in talking, and it wasn't until 1979 when some of the rescued Jews got together and put up a plaque in the village saying thanks to our rescuers. It wasn't until then that the story began to emerge, and it's come out in dribs and drabs ever since. There was a book in 1982, I think it was, by Philip Halley, which caused uproar in the village because they all thought he'd got it wrong. And there was an excellent film called Weapons of the Spirit, made by a guy called Pierre Sauvage, which has never been shown. It's never been shown in Ireland, it's never been shown in Britain, and it's hardly been shown in France. But it's a very fine film about what happened on the plateau. So gradually the story emerged, but I'm hoping that it's going to emerge in the hugest way with a book called The Greatest Escape.
Which is, of course, your own title. I've got to ask you, you know, you've written a few books on World War II, Peter, and this has been your latest and fascinating one that it is. When you're watching the news this week and you're looking at what's happening in the Middle East, and you're looking at Israel and you're looking at Palestine, you're looking at children and all these emotive pictures and desperate stories, and I know it myself, conversations with family and friends, it does kind of come up. And all roads lead to the past, and all roads tend to lead to the Holocaust, and all roads tend to lead to the foundation of the Jewish state of Israel. Does this cross your mind as you're watching the awful events unfolding? I'm not asking you to take a side, but I'm asking you to make a comment on it and the relevance of this period of history to where we are in 2014.
Well, I think so. I mean, but let's take the conversation wider than all the horrors that are going on in Gaza
sure.
and surrounding countryside at the moment. What I can't get over, I mean, I know from the letters and reviewing by members of the public and so on of my book, that people hear this story and hugely approve of what the people of Le Chambon did in rescuing all these people. They protected refugees, they shared their scarce food with them, they didn't ask questions, they just shoved them in the spare room and kept them quiet. And if you compare that with and I was saying, the universal response is to approve of that. How come we approve of that and continue to vote for politicians who promise to be the toughest in dealing with refugees? And being toughest means being nastiest, being most inhumane. How can we, on the one hand, admire the people of Le Chambon and then keep electing people who promise to be as beastly as possible to refugees?
Yeah, and again, we know what's happening with refugees from Syria and again from Gaza and beyond. The story We could be here for a lot longer, but alas, we have to leave it there for now. But I've enjoyed our conversation no end, and congratulations on the book, Peter, and I hope we cross paths again soon.
Indeed, Ryan. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time this morning. It's Peter Gross, who's the author of the book. It's called The Greatest Escape, How One French Community Saved Thousands of Lives from the Nazis. And what a story it is, and no doubt a film in the making there at some point. It's 10